Atari came in an atmosphere of very high expectations. So Nigerians of all political stripes from different parts of the country, everyday Nigerians, and then also, Nigerians that were middle class and politically active and even elites, had a strong expectation that he was going to come in and really put the nation back in order, undertake some reforms of the political system. What happened, though, was that he himself viewed his 2015 election victory as more of a finish line rather than a set of starting gates that he was bursting out of.
During the past few months, Nigeria has been in the news for the national Twitter ban that the country's President Buhari instituted over the summer. What used to be a platform that gave international reach to Nigeria's End SARS protests during the summer of 2020 is now banned for use in the country. President Buhari instituted this ban after Twitter deleted one of his tweets that threatened violence against Nigerian secessionists and temporarily banned his account. This ban is emblematic of a trend towards authoritarianism in the country. Among the many other issues that Nigeria is grappling with, such as insurgent groups and economic insecurity, growing authoritarianism is a development that has worrying implications. Today on the podcast, we discuss the implications of rising authoritarianism and other threats to Nigerian security with guest Matthew Page.
Matthew T. Page is a non-resident scholar with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, an associate fellow with the Africa Program at Chatham House, and a non-resident fellow with the Center for Democracy and Development in Abuja. Until recently, Page was the U.S. intelligence community's top Nigeria expert at the Department of State's Bureau of Intelligence and Research. He has also served on the National Intelligence Council, at the Defense Intelligence Agency, and as an international affairs fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations.
All right, Matt, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
So I'd like to get our conversation started with talking about the current president of Nigeria. So President Buhari was elected in 2015, defeating the then incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan. So can you tell us a little bit about who is President Buhari and what propelled him to victory?
Sure. When we talk about Nigerian politics, we often talk about the president. He's such a central figure in their political system, which is very much modeled on the U.S. system. So a very heavily centralized federation in the Nigerian case. And Buhari came to power in 2015 in a democratic election that was really the first transfer of power between two parties in Nigeria's recent history. So some of your listeners may know that Nigeria was under military rule for much of its history, and then in 1999 transferred back to civilian rule. So President Buhari has been the fourth president since Nigeria transferred back to civilian rule. But ironically, like one of his predecessors, Olusegun Obasanjo, who was elected president in 1999, President Buhari is a former general and actually ran Nigeria between December 1983, when he took power in a coup, and August 1985, when he was toppled in a coup as the military head of state. So in a way, this was Buhari's swan song, his Buhari 2.0, if you'd like to talk about it that way, where he came back to power, this time through the voting booth rather than through the barrel of a gun, and came back with a very, very different agenda in terms of what he was, the platform that he was running on. Buhari was appealing to his reputation that he earned during his time as a military leader as sort of a no-nonsense anti-corruption figure. The context was in 2015, the previous administration, run, as you mentioned, by President Goodluck Jonathan, had earned a reputation for corruption, particularly in the petroleum sector. The former oil minister, who was very close to Goodluck Jonathan, her name was Dezane Alison Madueke. She was seen as sort of emblematic of that government's extreme corruption, which they engaged in, which also coincided with a period of very high oil prices. Well, as we know, in sort of that 2014-2015 timeframe, oil prices crashed. Everyday Nigerians really hadn't seen any of the dividends of that oil boom. There was a ruling party, the People's Democratic Party, that Goodluck Jonathan was the head of and was running for re-election, had been in power since 1999. They, you know, it was sort of a, I guess, you know, you'd use the phrase, a sort of throw the bums out election, where people really were clamoring for a change. The electoral system in Nigeria is by no means perfect, but it had undergone some reforms where popular intentions, voting intentions, were to some extent being reflected at the ballot box. You know, there was a lot of rigging, but also there was a genuine sea change in public opinion towards Buhari. And what was at that time the newly united opposition party, the All Progressives Congress. So he was propelled to victory very simply on a pretty clear and consistent platform, which was to put an end or to rein in corruption, to improve the stability and security of the country, which, as we know, still to this day is very much, you know, it's very, very troubled country, especially in the Northeast, but also other regions of the country where violence and criminality, banditry and terrorism are a significant threat to everyday Nigerians. And he really promised to restore order, relying on his credentials, right, as a former military ruler. And then he was also making promises that sort of had a bit of a progressive ring to them about developing the agricultural sector, improving the power sector, all of these sectors of the economy that really had been neglected by the previous crop of elites that had dominated Nigeria's political system since 1999. So that was really what propelled him to victory, I think, and led to him taking office in 2015, and then also, to a certain extent, his re-election in 2019.
So it seems like Buhari campaigned on some pretty big promises. So during the last 5 or 6 years that he has been in charge of the country, what, if any, significant changes have happened during his time as president? And has he made good on these big electoral promises, such as reigning in corruption?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think Buhari came in an atmosphere of very high expectations. So Nigerians of all political stripes from different parts of the country, everyday Nigerians, and then also, you know, Nigerians that were middle class and politically active and even elites, had a strong expectation that he was going to come in and really put the nation back in order, undertake some reforms of the political system. What happened, though, was that as soon as he took office, really inertia set in. It took him several months just to name his team, name a cabinet team that was actually going to bring forth his agenda. And his agenda and vision that had been really touted on the campaign trail was not visibly being implemented. And I think it's clear now in retrospect that a lot of, you know, young advisors, you know, people who were around Buhari were really talking up that agenda, but he himself viewed his 2015 election victory as more of a finish line rather than a set of starting gates that he was bursting out of and implementing all of these changes. So he went after, you know, using the anti-corruption agencies, he went after individuals that were associated with the previous government. He attempted to investigate and prosecute and reclaim some of the stolen funds that had been allegedly stolen by them and bring those back. But really, since 2015, right, May 2015, when he took office to now, September 2021, there's been very minimal observable progress in these areas, which granted are very heavy lifts. These are very significant political and security challenges. You know, we've had the coronavirus pandemic. We've had Nigeria's, for much of the time he's been in office, has experienced a recession and economic contraction based on lower crude oil prices. But regardless of all those externalities, he's he's mismanaged. He and his team have really mismanaged many of these issues. And I think most importantly, the key promises that he made, particularly around anti-corruption, fighting corruption, and restoring security, have largely been unmet. And in fact, although I'm sure his fans would not agree, I think there's a broad cross-section of opinion which says that corruption is alive and well. Elite corruption, you know, there are highly corrupt people around Buhari, you know, very close to him, in his government, you know, in his ruling party, and he's done very little to in a sense improve or whiten or launder the political system in ways that it needed in order to function more effectively. And particularly the petroleum sector. And this is important because Buhari, like several presidents before him, has took on the petroleum minister portfolio himself. So in other words, you know, from the very start, he sent the message that the buck stopped with him when it came to the management of the petroleum sector, and particularly, you know, reducing petroleum sector corruption. And it's clear that really hasn't happened either. So I think that's a key point. And I think also, you know, his electoral promises surrounding the restoration of security have been largely unmet as well. And I think, you know, we can talk about that later in the discussion, but there are a lot of reasons for that, a lot of systemic flaws within the security sector that have been largely unaddressed. And those include, you know, endemic defense sector corruption, gross human rights violations by security personnel that, you know, undermine their ability to work effectively with civilian populations around the country. And then also, you know, an undercapitalization and underprofessionalization of these different security agencies in Nigeria. So there are, I don't mean to sort of, you know, come across and say that, you know, the sky is falling and Nigeria is hopeless, but there are just really systemic challenges in these different areas when it comes to corruption, when it comes to security, that work at a number of different levels that are really multi-layered, you know, are at the strategic levels, for the operational level and the tactical level. And for those really to begin, for that the trajectory to change on those issues and begin moving in a more productive direction, that requires an extremely dynamic and energized and sort of open-minded and engaged leader who you know, is able to mobilize a much broader skilled team of individuals who can themselves exert strong leadership over different parts of government. And that person just isn't Buhari. Buhari is, I think, more of a passive figure who believes that just by sort of sitting on the presidential throne in Nigeria, that somehow by osmosis, the country is going to function better than it did under what he views as his corrupt civilian predecessors. And that, of course, just hasn't been the case at all.
Right. So if, as you say, President Buhari has been more of a passive figure and hasn't really made good on the electoral promises that he campaigned on in 2015, can you shine some light on why he was reelected in 2019?
That's a really good question. You know, and it's not got a sort of a simple answer by any means. So, firstly, Buhari has genuine popularity among a certain section of society. He's a very populist figure. He's sort of a, you know, he's a bit of a hero, especially of the working classes, or certainly, you know, was initially. He was sort of a household name in that way. And as I mentioned earlier on, people looked back very nostalgically at his brief period as military ruler between, 1984, 1985 timeframe. And of course, subsequently, you know, his time in power was contrasted to subsequent military rulers who were much more corrupt and mismanaged the economy and country to a much greater extent. He and his opposition party, you know, after taking power in 2015, were quite effective at exerting control and politically manipulating, you know, the instruments of state that they needed to stay in power through 2019. So this included the, you know, Electoral Commission, you know, just sort of getting their teeth and claws, if you will, into different pots of public funds, you know, that would fund their 2019 electoral campaign. I mean, this is true in any country, but especially in Nigeria. You know, once politicians finish one campaign, they begin to think ahead towards the next one, and, you know, immediately, and they begin, you know, essentially the 2019 campaign began, you know, very, you know, early on in President Buhari's first term, even though at that time, of course, his health was very much in question. He experienced a very significant health scare, which many people, you know, attribute to a very advanced form of cancer, which he was able to beat through, you know, top quality medical care, and has since, you know, clearly in remission from that health scare. But, you know, so the fact that, you know, he was healthy and able to run again in 2019 was a major boost to the ruling party. And then I think another really clear and important factor is that the opposition party, the main opposition party, the People's Democratic Party, which I mentioned, the PDP, which was in power from 1999 until 2015, it was really thrown for a loop, you know, being out of power. It had not been used to that. And a lot of the politicians who did not change parties and move to President Buhari's All Progressives Congress before the 2015 election, many of them did quite quickly after the 2015 election, because in the Nigerian political context, political parties don't really have any ideology per se. They're really just these competing national networks of elites. And so for them, they have very few incentives to, in a sense, right, stay in opposition. And instead, they have huge incentives to what in Nigerian political parlance is called cross-carpeting or decamping to the ruling party in order to, you know, not necessarily even then go on and become significant figures in that party, but in a way just to protect their interests and prevent themselves, especially in the context of Buhari's anti-corruption campaign, from being put under a microscope. And so that was another failing during Buhari's first term, was there's a widespread perception that those former ruling party politicians that decamped, that, you know, switched sides and joined his party, were essentially given either a free pass or treated very lightly in terms of, you know, going after their, you know, their former corrupt acts, and those being investigated and them being punished for those things. And that perception, I think, exists to this day, is that the Buhari administration is far more adept at going after its political enemies who've engaged in corruption than they are sort of investigating individuals within their own party, within the ruling party, and within the government or recently served in government who have been credibly implicated in corruption. So I think those are the sort of, I guess, you know, three main reasons. Is one is, you know, Buhari's lingering popularity. Two is his ruling party's ability to quickly, in a sense, mimic their predecessor and engage in all the same tricks and strategies and misuse of public funds in order to propel themselves into a second term in office. And then I think the third factor is the weakness, you know, the weakening of the opposition over the course of Buhari's first term. And I would argue, you know, it continues now, 6-7 years into his tenure.
So on the topic of the Buhari administration going after political opponents, this summer, President Buhari imposed a national ban on Twitter as part of his clampdown on free speech. Why did the Buhari administration institute this ban? And what has been the reaction to this policy? And does this have any larger consequences, more broader impact on the state of democracy and the specter of authoritarianism in Nigeria?
No, that's an excellent question. And as we know, I mean, you all who are listening to this podcast have a much more, you know, global perspective in terms of, you know, other countries, right, that are on the lists of countries that have either banned or interfered with social media, particularly Twitter, but also other, you know, other forms of internet manipulation and control that authoritarian regimes, whether they be, you know, North Korea, right, Iran, China, have engaged in to basically try to control their citizens' internet access and their use of the internet, particularly in terms of role in generating political opposition to ruling elites. And with this ban, Nigeria has unfortunately joined a very, you know, small and not particularly popular club of nations that have engaged in this sort of activity. So this ban on Twitter came about quite simply because President Buhari or his media advisors, who in their own past election campaigns had leveraged Twitter very effectively. I mean, one factor in the 2015 election victory that I didn't mention was the then opposition party, the people around Buhari, leveraging social media, leveraging Facebook, Twitter, other platforms to mobilize voters, to mobilize younger voters especially, and civically minded voters who were on Twitter and so forth. So this was the irony, right, of a government that had actually come to power very much through the help of Twitter, now clamping down on it because, as I mentioned, President Buhari, from his account, he made a tweet which was very menacing towards a particular sector of the country, particularly ethnic group within the country, people in the southeast of Nigeria who are of the Igbo ethnicity that harken back towards the civil war, which Buhari fought in as a young officer on the government side, was caused when the southeast part of the country attempted to secede from Nigeria and declare independence. That there were a lot, it's a very complicated conflict. There's a lot of reasons why that secession took place. And the death toll in that conflict was extraordinarily high. Up to 3 million people died, primarily through starvation and disease, of course, as happens in most wars rather than actual military fatalities. So it was very clear that President Buhari's tweet, or the tweet that came from his account, was very much borderline in terms of what was acceptable on, according to Twitter's terms of use and, its community rules. And given that he was a prominent political figure as well, of course, and had a very wide reach. So Twitter simply removed that tweet under its terms of use. And this was very upsetting to Buhari personally, to his information minister, whose name is Lai Mohammed, and of course to the coterie of close advisors who were around Buhari, and sort of their reaction in the moment, and the sort of policy tantrum, if you will, was to ban Twitter nationwide, and again this goes back to I think a topic we'll discuss later in the discussion, which is increasing authoritarianism in Nigeria. Which is, they used a lot of, put a lot of government pressure on internet providers, on media platforms, you know, both social media and traditional media, to basically not engage on Twitter anymore. And millions of Nigerians responded to this by downloading VPNs to their phone, the virtual private networks, and continuing to engage on Twitter in relation to this ban. So there's been discussion recently, where Nigerian government officials have promised to lift the ban on Twitter in the foreseeable future. And this, this is something that is obviously long overdue. I think we're well over 100 days now into the Twitter ban. And they've also, you know, been very reticent because, you know, they don't want to lose face and climb down from this, what is ultimately a very untenable position that's been widely criticized, although not particularly strongly by Nigeria's international partners and by, you know, by the international community. So the reaction from the citizens has been obviously highly negative. The economic consequences, right, of banning a particular social media platform that many Nigerians actually use as a business tool, you know, to conduct transactions and market their businesses, you know, at the very grassroots level is extremely problematic as well. So, the government is looking for a face-saving way out of this. I don't know that they've actually really found it in the demand that Twitter set up an office in Nigeria. And I think we could see again down the line, 6 months from now, again, a year from now, when these type of incidents or flare-ups happen again, we could see, you know, Nigerian elites, either the Buhari government or its successor, banning Twitter, you know, shutting down the internet, you know, using these types of authoritarian tactics, because they've largely succeeded in using this tactic and have experienced very few international consequences as a result, or domestic consequences.
So do you think this is a trend that you would see or expect to continue to possibly escalate? And why or why not?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think we will see it in the future because we've seen as a pattern in Nigerian politics in the past, and this is true, I guess, in other countries as well, where governments or politicians will try to float balloons, right? They'll float a trial balloon to see if how much pushback they get, both domestically and internationally, from a particular gambit. And so now that the Buhari government has, in a sense, crossed a line or crossed this Rubicon in terms of banning social media, albeit selectively, and not really experienced the significant or tangible blowback as a result, particularly from the international community. I mean, the United States has been, I think, particularly has particularly failed to really hold the Nigerian government to account on this. Other countries were a little more vocal and a little more strident in their condemnation of the Twitter ban and other affronts to Nigeria's democratic trajectory than Washington has been. But yeah, I think we will see more of this in the future and the potential escalation. And like I said, not just from the Buhari administration, but from whatever constellation of Nigerian elites come to power in 2023.
So authoritarianism is not the only issue that Nigeria has been contending with recently. The country's also faced ongoing economic and security-related instability in the form of extreme poverty and ongoing insurgency ongoing insurgency in various states. So are these challenges a risk for the long-term security of Nigeria? And how about for the security of neighboring countries in the region as a whole?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, Nigeria's always faced a range of security threats, but it's one which certainly from the outside looking in can sometimes be exaggerated. I mean, Nigeria is a very large country very geographically and culturally diverse. I think when we think about insecurity in Nigeria political instability, you know, we really need to think about Nigeria as 36, you know, countries within a country. So Nigeria is a federal construct where there are 36 states and a federal capital territory, much like Washington, D.C., you know, the District of Columbia, where the seat of national government is, and that's in the center of the country in a sort of what at the time was conceived of sort of neutral ground between north and south. And to a great extent, the insecurity experienced by people is often limited to those states or two or three of those states at a time, because the drivers of those conflicts, right, are often very, very local. They often have to do with, you know, they're manifold. They often have to do with, right, cycles of violence that occur over land use or occur over, you know, competition for resources, competition for, you know, between farmers and livestock herders. So pastoralists is another reason. And of course, in northeastern Nigeria, you know, that's a little bit of its own kettle of fish there, because you've had an insurgency, an Islamic terrorist insurgency, which is cross-border and has been ongoing there for a long time, but has been fueled not just by, you know, many of the traditional factors that contribute to insurgencies, whether it be ideology or, you know, the desperate situation faced by the local population, but also by a mishandling of the insurgency by the Nigerian state and the Nigerian military and police and security services. So in many parts of Nigeria, the state is exacerbating, right, this violence, this insecurity, with all of the sort of socioeconomic effects that you would expect to see from those failures. And these conflicts, you know, flare up from time to time. They ebb and flow. And what we're seeing right now is a real uptick across the country, and flare-ups in parts of the country that maybe a decade ago were not particularly susceptible to insecurity, communal conflict, banditry, and I'm thinking particularly the Northwest. So the Northwest of Nigeria, where we read headlines coming out of places like Zamfara State or Katsina State, which is actually the home state of President Buhari, are now experiencing extreme, violent attacks, kidnapping of school children and other individuals from communities, which are really out of control and which have really exceeded the ability of the nation to combat. Because you have to remember, in Nigeria, right, it's a federal structure. So there's a federal military, there's a federal police force. You know, individual states don't really have their own police forces like they say they do in the, you know, like in the United States, where, you know, individual states, you know, have a state police force and local police forces. That just doesn't exist in Nigeria. So again, the buck kind of stops with Buhari in terms of getting a handle on this insecurity, which again is long running, multifaceted, by no means something that, you know, he or any of his top generals could necessarily solve overnight, but their missteps have really made things worse, and their inaction and inability to arrest some of this insecurity and change its trajectory is really the reason why we see these challenges spiraling out of control now. And to answer your question on whether or not this instability will sort of spill over into neighboring countries and the region as a whole, I think I would go back to the point I was making earlier about Nigeria being a federation of these 36 country-sized states that have got, you know, populations the size of other African countries. And, you know, the fact that it's sometimes it's very hard for these conflicts or for this instability to jump those fire breaks, you know, because they are so very much localized. You know, conflict doesn't spread like a wildfire across a prairie, typically. So in the northeast of the country, we do see obviously spillover of the conflict into northern Cameroon, Chad, and eastern Niger. But Nigeria's other communal conflicts aren't necessarily going to spark, you know, conflict in that same way. You know, each of these conflicts are just going to behave very differently because they have very sort of idiosyncratic drivers and consequences. And really will continue to be primarily a domestic problem moving forward.
The United States and Nigeria have long been close partners. You know, the United States is an important trading partner, if not the main trading partner for Nigeria, as well as an important diplomatic partner as well. You mentioned before that the United States has not responded strongly to Buhari's Twitter ban. And so far, we've discussed various facets of the instability, the violence, the state's responsibility in exacerbating those such conditions, as well as the specter of authoritarianism in Nigeria. Has the United States responded in any way to these new developments, like rising authoritarianism or instability?
No, that's a really good question. Yeah, so the partnership between the U.S. and Nigeria historically has always been very, very strong. I mean, the United States plays host to one of the largest, if not the largest, population of Nigerians living in the diaspora. You know, well over a million Nigerian Americans, and of course, you know, many more who have come and studied here and visited relatives, of course, just like there are many Nigerians and people of Nigerian ancestry living in the UK. And so this has been going on for a long time. You know, so this partnership or this relationship between the US and Nigeria is longstanding. It largely weathered many difficult episodes, right? Whether that be the Civil War, whether that be the Cold War, or the periods of military rule in Nigeria, where obviously, you know, democracy was receding and there were, you know, significant concerns in Washington about, you know, Nigeria's behavior both internally and in the region. And so, you know, I always say that, you know, there isn't a friendship between the U.S. and Nigeria. It's more of a family relationship. You know, we're so close that we kind of can't get rid of each other, even if we wanted to. You know, we can never break up because we're that close. We are like family. And again, I mentioned that the Nigerian constitution is very much modeled off of the American constitution. You know, there are tons of cultural, both, you know, in terms of like art and literature, and then also in terms of pop culture ties between the U.S. and Nigeria. So those things are very durable. And I think, you know, the people to people connections will persist and hopefully grow. And when it comes to U.S. Nigeria policy, which will probably be, you know, actually have a lot of interest to your listeners, given their interest, you know, in diplomacy and international affairs. But to most, I think Nigerians and Americans aren't really necessarily on their radar. But I think if you look with a more critical eye at U.S. policy towards Nigeria, as I have, you know, both having been inside government until 2016 and then outside government, there's a lot of inconsistency and incoherence, especially when it comes to really important sort of values-based interests like human rights, democracy and governance, anti-corruption, and so forth. These are issues where the U.S. consistently says the right things. You know, really, they may not say them particularly loudly or in ways in which are timed in a way to get a reaction or to put in context some sort of action that the Nigerian government has taken. But you know, generally speaking, right, this is part of our policy narrative around Nigeria. I think the big problem, though, is that when it comes to U.S. policy actions towards Nigeria, we tend to undermine that messaging. You know, a really good example is the decision that was made actually by the Obama administration, but then was accelerated and really pushed through by the Trump administration to sell 12 combat aircraft to Nigeria at a cost of $500 million to the Nigerian state, to the Nigerian people and government. This was a very controversial decision, given that the Nigerian Air Force just this week, for example, bombed a civilian target by accident and has a track record more generally, its military, of committing really quite horrific gross human rights violations. So, for example, in December 2015, you know, just around the time that this sale was being concluded, the Nigerian army committed a mass killing of over 300 people in the northern city of Zaria. Also, from about 2013 onwards, Nigeria has operated, the Nigerian military has operated a series of extrajudicial secret detention camps in which thousands of detainees related to the Boko Haram insurgency, many of whom had nothing to do with Boko Haram, died from neglect, torture, and disease, and so forth. So these sort of aberrations or problems, along with, you know, the significant elite corruption, the authoritarian tendencies that we talked about in terms of the Twitter ban, but also in October 2020, the military opening fire on peaceful protesters who were protesting, ironically, against police brutality. Many of your listeners will know, have heard of these. They were called the End SARS protests. SARS referring to the Special Anti-Robbery Squad, which was a police unit that was particularly notorious in terms of committing abuses. The U.S. government, unlike its British, EU, Canadian counterparts, for example, were silent in the wake of the SARS killings for several days. And so in through that silence, they've essentially been giving these sort of tacit winks and nods to the Buhari government in this case, right? Because they're the government in power, that their behavior is borderline, but ultimately not a deal breaker in terms of, you know, continuing to enjoy a very strong bilateral relationship with the United States. And that, I think, is problematic because, again, I would argue you know, that the Buhari administration's conduct resembles in many ways, or is in fact more problematic than the military dictatorships, right, of the 80s and 90s, during which time U.S.-Nigeria relations were at times very poor because of those abuses and excesses that those governments committed. So that would be my take, I guess, on where U.S. Africa policymakers are going wrong in terms of their, like I said, mixed messages, inconsistencies, and incoherence when it comes to U.S.-Nigeria policy.
So just in the context of everything that we've just discussed today and bringing it back to national politics in Nigeria, there is growing concern from many, not all, but many, that Nigeria is on track to become a quote-unquote failed state amidst high levels of corruption, instability, like the things that we've discussed in this podcast episode. So in your view, to what extent is this fear valid? And can President Buhari chart a different course for Nigeria's future?
Yeah, that's a really good point. There has been a lot of discussion recently on whether, or debate, I should say, on whether Nigeria is or is not a failed state. Yeah, there are strong feelings on both sides. I personally come down, and you know, I don't mean to be noncommittal here, but I personally come down on the side of the argument that it isn't really helpful to label Nigeria a failed state or not. Like, that doesn't, even if we're never going to all agree that that's the case. And certainly the Nigerian government is never going to admit that it's failing or has failed. And nor would that necessarily be productive. So Nigeria is obviously a state that faces these enormous challenges. You know, the definition of a failed state is obviously one for debate as well, but it generally means, right, a country whose government is unable to exert control or reliable authority over large parts of its territory. And presumably, right, that implies that it's unable to really provide any meaningful services, especially basic policing and dispute resolution, right, rule of law in much of its territory. And one could argue that to one or extent or another, that's been true in Nigeria for a long time. And especially depending on which part of Nigeria you're talking about, because as I mentioned, we shouldn't, you know, for the purposes of this podcast, it's fine to talk about Nigeria sort of in the broad brush sense. But as I mentioned earlier, we should, you know, if we had the time, we should really be talking, right, about Nigeria in terms of its 36 component parts. And, you know, every state is different in terms of what, you know, what's going on there. So is it fair to say that Borno state is a failed state within Nigeria, or at the moment Zamfara state, or, you know, large parts of Kaduna state are failed states? Yeah, I mean, arguably that is possibly fair to say. But certainly there are also parts of Nigeria, especially in the the more upscale parts of Lagos or the more prosperous neighborhoods of Abuja that are completely almost immune or insulated from that state failure, and where the state is alive and well. So rather than it, you know, being a fear or a label that we apply to Nigeria, I think, you know, it's not necessarily helpful, and we should sort of maybe, you know, look for other ways to talk about Nigeria's challenge and sort of disaggregate them and come up, right, with more feasible solutions on how to tackle them. But, and that brings us to the sort of final question, right, which is, can President Buhari, who's basically got less than 2 years left in office, I mean, he will hand over power in May of 2023, but fundamentally, he's got even less time than that, because it's in all likelihood the Nigerian presidential elections will be scheduled for January 2023. So, you know, the preparations from them, the political machinations, the internal party maneuvering and primary processes are already well underway in terms of choosing President Buhari's successor, because he can't run again. He's term limited. So as a second term, the APC will have to field a new candidate in 2023. And then, of course, the opposition, People's Democratic Party as well. And then potentially third party candidates, which if you again talk to Nigerians who are very passionate about political reform and change, would argue, you know, that's really a key part of breaking the very destructive cycle of partisan politics in Nigeria, is having a really credible third party candidate come in and present an alternative to the two main parties, who in many ways behave very similarly. So I think it's, you know, all of us can hope for a miracle, but I think it's very unlikely that President Buhari is going to suddenly have an epiphany in his final, you know, 16 months in office or what have you, and suddenly kick into high gear and take some of the really important steps that need to be taken in order to take Nigeria onto a different course. And again, really, it's not about, you know, flipping a switch, right, from bad to good. It's about changing. It's about renavigating and charting a new course, right? Like you would, you know, turn around an ocean liner and change the trajectory of the country in a fundamentally different way. So we saw a couple of weeks ago, President Buhari undertook a cabinet reshuffle. He fired two ministers, but again, this was not It wasn't clear that this was driven by any, you know, there are a lot of poorly performing ministers in President Buhari's government, and it was not apparent that these two were particularly less effective than many of the other ones, which he kept in office. So I think we're not going to see any really radical changes or departures from the, you know, largely ineffective and undynamic form of governance that we've seen since 2015 under President Buhari. And I, like many Nigerians, have fallen into the trap of saying, well, you know, all we can do now is look forward to 2023 and maybe there'll be a change then. But I think because Nigerian politics is very much something that's been already captured by, like I mentioned, these jockeying networks of the same national and state elites, I think it's unlikely that we're going to see some sort of dynamic reformist figure emerge, you know, as a major party candidate in 2023. All we can hope for, again, is one that, you know, potentially is a little more dynamic, a little more effective, capable of picking a better team to and willing to delegate authorities to them than Buhari has been.
Mm-hmm. Matt, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me. It's always great to talk Nigeria.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and to the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave us a rating. We'll see you next time.